Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this week we're going to be taking a look at two cases. One is hotter than molten lava. George Zimmerman, who is accused of killing black teenager Trayvon Martin. The second case is one that has been brewing for 30 years. Even though it's mostly solved, it just refuses to give up all of the secrets. Bar owner Ronald Schaff and his bartender Patricia Freeman were killed execution style in the back room of the bar in the early mornings. I have some wonderful guests from the wilds of L.A., well-known and well-respected attorney Peter Haven. Peter, welcome, and happy Father's Day.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. It's a pleasure to be here. Happy Father's Day to everyone. I just got off a long conversation with my dad, and it was great to speak to him. Happy Father's Day to everyone.
All right. I have to share a funny little story. I woke up this morning and did my usual thing of doing nothing other than sitting at the computer. My wife gave me a happy Father's Day card and a package. And it was one of those really, really great meat thermometers. You know, you poke it in the meat and the you can attach it to the side of the oven, you know, through magnets. I thought that was wonderful. But she wasn't done. She also gave me a large slab of beef so that I'd be able to check this critter out.
Good stuff.
You're right. Yeah. And from Orlando, Florida, we have Dave Neckel. Dave is an independent blogger / reporter. He hit my radar when he managed to get press credentials for the Casey Anthony trial. That was a tough road to hoe. Now he's managed to get himself press creds for the Zimmerman trial. And I know he spent some time watching the case unfold. Dave, welcome.
Well, hello there. How is everyone? I think we should be calling this the Peter, Paul, and Simon show. Mary's gone. Yeah.
There you go. And also on the program is Paul Schaff. I've known Paul for several years. His quest for justice has taken a very long and winding road. Every time that I think the case is done, it takes on a new direction. Paul, welcome.
Well, thank you, Simon. Happy Father's Day to everybody.
All right. I'm going to kick off with the Zimmerman trial, seeing as it's, you know, hotter than molten lava. It's got to be pretty hard to, you know, seat a jury when you've been in the national press day in, day out, month after month. Peter, I know you've seen this. Is it possible to find a jury that doesn't have a bias?
Yeah, it's definitely possible to find a jury that doesn't have bias. We have to distinguish between jurors that are familiar with the case, and I think, you know, many people will be familiar with the case, if not just about everyone, versus people who, for whatever reason, have formulated some belief or preconception that will prevent them from fairly and impartially evaluating the evidence. And, you know, it's not so much that they've been exposed to it as the bigger question is whether or not any of them have some sort of predisposition that will prevent them from being fair and impartial with respect to looking at the evidence. And there's no doubt in my mind that they will find such a jury.
Okay, Dave, you've been in the courtroom, you've watched it, and you can't name names. You know, everyone's known as, you know, B21 or, you know,
bingo.
Whatever.
Right.
This case has received so much publicity. You know, can you find an impartial jury that has more than two synapses firing?
Yes, I believe so. First of all, you've got to worry about there was a woman there who claimed to know absolutely nothing. And you have to, you know, you're looking at this as a prosecutor and a defense attorney and trying to formulate what's actually going on inside this person's mind. If they didn't really hear anything about it, are they incompetent? In other words, do they not stay current with everyday events in the news or what goes on around them? Well, that's not the kind of a person that you want to have on your jury. At the same time, is the person lying to you? And they know something more than what they're admitting to. And you don't want to have that kind of a person on your jury, obviously. But now, I'm a writer. I write about it. And I've had people come up to me and tell me a lot of things about this case. Like I had someone tell me last week that, well, they already sat a jury. I mean, there's already a jury. It's all these six men. I said, no, that's what I'm going to go to court for. He says, baloney. So the guy, some people just don't know. They don't care to know. I mean, these are the same people that come up to you and say, what's going on with the case? I don't really care about it. And you never know where they're coming from. But when they're put on that stand and sworn to tell the truth, hopefully they're going to tell you the way it is. And I think you can easily see someone in Seminole County, and Mark O'Mara feels the same way. This is not going to go anywhere. I'm just going to stay right here.
Okay. I'm going to bring our third guest in. Paul, you probably don't know much about this case, but
not too much.
Right? Does it bother you? You know, the way the justice system works. You know, we need to find in this case six people that haven't been tainted by the press. And, you know, can render an impartial verdict?
Yeah, this one's a little bit difficult because we certainly, with the press, have rushed to a lot of judgments. And this is something that really needs to be looked at based on the facts, not the accusations. I mean, what happened is, somehow things got escalated to a point where a young boy was killed. And for it to kind of just go to the media as, you know, to fill, you know, news stories and stuff like that and not allow the justice system to go into effect, I think is somewhat of a crime.
Peter, you know, the laws change, you know, county by county and certainly state by state. In this particular case, they're going to impanel a jury of six. Apparently, this is normal in Florida. Would that be normal in California?
No, it would not. And I was actually surprised to hear about this. I actually haven't seen confirmation of this, but I'm taking your understanding of it as correct. In California, it would be a 12-person jury, and to me, it's very rare to see a criminal jury of this type of crime be tried by six people. In my opinion, it seems to me that the defense is giving up a lot. In California, you would need a unanimous 12-person jury verdict. And to have, you know, so if you were giving up six jurors, you're giving up basically a 1 in 12 chance of getting one juror to conclude that the prosecution has failed to present its burden of proof. And when you reduce it to six, you're basically you know, making it easier to get a unanimous decision, in my opinion. And I'm actually surprised to hear about this. And but I guess if that's the case, that's the law in Florida, and it hasn't been challenged at the Supreme Court level, as far as I can tell.
Dave, I asked you the same question on the phone earlier today. Do you want to explain the way that you understand the Florida laws?
Yes. It's very easy because Florida Statute 913.10 explains it clear and simply. Number of jurors, 12 persons shall constitute a jury to try all capital cases. So you understand that's only capital cases, like Casey Anthony was a capital murder case. And six persons shall constitute a jury to try all other criminal cases. Second-degree murder is not a capital crime. And that's basically the simplest way to put it. It's just in the statute.
I have to admit that I'm shocked. As I'm sure you are, Peter.
Well, I think it was just very well explained to me, and this was an area of the law that I was unfamiliar with in the state of Florida, and to my knowledge, there's nothing comparable to that in the state of California. But if that's the law of the legislature of the state of Florida, then that is the law. You know, there's a question here about minimal due process. The prosecution must have sufficient due process. That's a constitutional requirement. And then a secondary constitutional requirement is they have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And the Florida legislature has stated that in this type of crime, they can prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt with only six people, and that's not a violation of due process, and that's why Florida believes this complies with the Constitution. And I don't know if it's ever been challenged to the U.S. Supreme Court. I suspect it probably has. So this is the law, and this is the law of the case, and this is what the jury will be, six people.
Now, I don't know whether, you know, when you bring up challenge to the U.S. Supreme Court, I don't know. I think the Supreme Court probably would have decided this is a state matter. Like Utah might be different. You know, each state, I guess, is allowed to come up with their own.
They are.
Yeah.
But they must still comply with the United States Constitution. And I don't know if the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on whether six people on a jury in a criminal matter would meet constitutional due process for a murder conviction. I suspect that if this law has been on the books for a while, that it has survived.
Yes, it has.
Okay, well, I suspect it's probably survived any Supreme Court challenge to that effect. And then if that's the case, then it defaults
1940 yeah. It's been on the books.
Then it defaults to what you just described, which is the states have the right to, within the constitutional minimums, they have the right to do what they want.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think, in other words, I don't think this would be brought up on appeal.
Well, I think it would. It could be brought up on appeal. There's no reason, you know, if he's convicted, the defendants can raise anything they want on appeal, and they typically don't limit themselves. They argue that evidence was improperly admitted. They argue that the jury shouldn't have reached the conclusion that it did, notwithstanding the evidence. And someone may throw in a constitutional challenge to this issue as well. But I suspect that's already been done before, and it's failed, and there you go.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, Paul, I know you know little about this case, but have you ever heard of a six-person jury?
Well, I think they would love that in Illinois. you know, I would, you know, because I'm listening to all this stuff, and what I know is, you know, corruption and things like that. And there's, you know, a lot of court fixings, you know, is related to the Chicago mob or the Chicago outfit. And I think they would love a program like that where they only had six jurors that they had to corrupt. It'd be a lot easier than 12. So it does seem kind of rigged, whether it's rigged or not.
No. That was kind of a mean thing to say. So, Zimmerman, is he going to walk away scot-free?
Who are you asking that? But I will say this first, that in 1970, there was a Williams versus Florida. The Supreme Court reconsidered an earlier decision from 1898 that a 12-person jury, neither more nor less, was a constitutional requirement. So it was a six-member jury conviction, or affirmed the conviction from a six-member jury, that the U.S. Supreme Court did reconsider that earlier issue. So,
did you just find that out, or?
Yeah, no, I just did find that out. Fortunately, I can sit and look.
Well, that's
now,
good
was,
to know. I suspected that it had, and basically, just so everyone is clear, Florida has decided, apparently pursuant to its statute, that a 12-person jury is required for all capital crimes.
Capital, that's what I said.
And a capital crime is a crime for which you can receive the death penalty.
That's right.
And in any other crime, a 6-person jury is sufficient. Now, you know, you learn something new every day. I had never heard of this before. But apparently it's been on the books for some time in the state of Florida, and as you just pointed out, it has survived a test to the U.S. Supreme Court, so there
you
go.
That's probably why Florida has better oranges than California.
Now,
we won't go there.
Will Zimmerman walk? You know, I don't think anybody ever gets out of a situation like this, quote-unquote, scot-free. You know, going through the process, living with the process, coming out of the process, and then living with the rest of your life. I don't know what scot-free would ever mean. I personally, from the information and evidence I've seen, I'm not convinced they're going to be able to get a conviction simply because there does seem to be a debate about him needing self-defense to protect himself. And to me, that creates a reasonable doubt. So, I believe the evidence is sufficient to give rise to a reasonable doubt, and I think that this jury will probably find a reasonable doubt. That's my opinion from afar. That could change, you know, obviously as the trial develops.
Dave, I have to ask you. You've been sitting in the courtroom. Yeah, the slugfest has gone on. You know, who can be on the jury? Do you have any opinion? Are people trying to get on or trying to get off this case?
Both, but initially, what I observed, along with several of the other journalists, we commented during breaks, you know, whenever, lunchtime, at the end, that it did seem like some of them were begging to get on the jury. It's like you could almost smell, like they could almost smell a book deal. But it was something that was never discussed. I mean, nobody ever said anything about that. But, yeah, there were some people that really wanted to get on it. There were some they weren't sure whether it was going to be a sequestered jury or not, some that had hardships, some that really didn't want to get on it because of that remote possibility. Well, the judge did subsequently decide to sequester the jury. And there are many reasons why she did, but that's not really what you're asking. So for the most part, I think people really felt compelled to just do their civic duty. And they were aware that I'm sure, Peter, you know this, and it becomes redundant to the ones who sit out in the gallery every day, the people like me that are there day after day after day. You hear the little story about the red car, the blue car, and you obviously you know that, you know, and I don't know if you know it, Simon.
Tell us the version of it you most recently heard, because it changed.
Well, it's the same version. Well, I'm getting it basically from the defense and the prosecution. If the defense does it or the prosecution doesn't bring it up, then the defense does. So, and I don't know how they decide who gets to bring it up. Maybe if one just forgets to do it, but usually it's the prosecution. And it's like if you saw on television, if you saw a report on television, not saying that you're a witness to this, but you just happened to see a report on television, read it in the newspaper, you know, read it on the internet, that a car was involved, you know, a blue car was involved in an accident. And then you start believing that it was a blue car. In court, would you be able to forget that it was a blue car and start from scratch if the evidence, only the evidence shown in court, it shows that it was really, in fact, what did I say, a red car, then it's a blue car. Whichever one I said that you saw in the paper, it's not that color, it's this color from the evidence that's shown. And sure, everyone says I would be able to forget that if I read it was a blue car, if I saw in the news they reported it as a blue car, and you presented evidence proving that it was a red car, I would believe the evidence that was shown me in court. So
whoa.
Basically, that's the story. Is that the way you know it?
I've heard it different versions, but it basically comes down to the same thing, which is what I was talking about earlier. Are you capable of making a fair and impartial ruling in this case based on the evidence that you receive in the courtroom, regardless of whatever preconception you have, whatever information you've heard? Are you capable of looking at the evidence presented to you here and making a fair and impartial decision? And that is basically the entire process of jury selection. The big overview is that's what's being determined. Now that's the big stated question. The unstated question that each lawyer is trying to jockey for, well, some lawyers do so more than others, is can I find a juror who I think is in my favor? And I don't think that's a very worthwhile task.
I agree with you.
But some attorneys do. I don't think these attorneys are doing that, but some attorneys do.
No, I agree with you. I don't think they are either. I think you know, a lot of people aren't aware of that, you know, in this case, you get 10 peremptory strikes and unlimited strikes for cause.
Yeah.
So it's not like you have to really do a lot of, for lack of a better term, political maneuvering.
Well, the interesting part about voir dire is how many, with a six-person panel, are they examining or talking to six jurors at a time or 12 jurors at a time? You know, what happens is typically they bring in a whole pool of potential.
Well, they will. If they were questioning them individually first, and then they're going to bring in a pool and question them as a group. And then, of course, that would be like asking one a question and then asking another one, what do you think about the same thing?
So they're actually
questioning, if I may,
they're actually questioning individual jurors in isolation one at a time?
Yes.
Wow, that's interesting. So, you know, many times what happens is they just bring in a big group of potential jurors.
Yeah.
You know, they have a big room downstairs, and just so everyone knows, they bring in 40 or 50 jurors, and they sit in the galley, and then they put 6 or 10 or 12 in the jury box.
Well, that's
the
way they did it with me when I was called in for jury duty, and I, of course, live in the same town, Seminole. So when I was called, I had a really terrible flu. But we were all put in together, and then the attorneys asked this question exactly the way you're saying it.
And
but in this case, they're coming in individually. And
you know,
then
interesting
there's
about
a pool
the mass
of 28.
Approach. Yeah, what's interesting about the mass approach is that if you're a lawyer conducting that voir dire, you're asking 12 people in the box who are potential jurors, but every juror in the audience is listening and watching it. So you know you're going to lose some people on this panel, or you're likely to. But you're mindful of the fact that all the jurors out there in the audience are watching while all this goes on, and they're going to be the next up into the box if people get dismissed.
Well, I wonder if it has something to do with pinging each other. In other words, there was a guy, or there's a woman who came in. She was eventually dismissed, and just dismissed. I mean, I don't think there was any argument over her, although I'm getting into writing about the reason why, why I think she was dismissed. But she was really a pro-Zimmerman advocate. I mean, a pro-Zimmerman. And she, Second Amendment rights, pro-gun. But nothing wrong with that. That's not my point. But she took it to a different level. And, you know, everybody has a right to bear arms. That's okay. So basically that, because George had a right to bear arms, he had every right to shoot the kid. And that went well beyond, you know, what you consider. Now, had she said that in that pool, would that have tainted anyone else? And that's where you can go in there and individually, summarily dismiss a person without changing anyone else's opinion on that panel, you know,
yeah.
The pool.
Okay. Paul, I have to ask you. I know that you don't know much about the Zimmerman case, but you got to have some thoughts.
Yeah. It's rigged to fail. I mean, that's the way I'm looking at it. You know, somebody's going to lose. And whoever's going to lose, it's going to be a big blow. And it seems like that they're going to have a hook to hang their hat on for injustice. And to me, it seems inconceivable why you would start something that way, you know, in the very beginning. You know, who knows what's going to come out in this whole thing. But it already seems like somebody's got a place to hang their hat for injustice.
Right. That was really a great quote. A place to hang your hat for injustice. In this particular case, you know, it's a white guy killing a black teenager.
But it's not. No, it's not. You know, and Zimmerman was the first person to come out and say that he didn't consider himself to be white. He has black blood in him, and he considers himself to be Hispanic with black blood. So basically, he walked away from the white race, and I don't blame him almost in the sense that had he come out and said, no, I consider myself to be white, then it could easily be conceived that way as a racial thing. But, you know, I don't think it really comes down to that issue at all. I don't think, I think just like in the O.J. case, if George Zimmerman is found innocent, they're not guilty, then I don't think there's going to be racial riots. I think, though, that there's going to be the opportunity for the Martin family to take George Zimmerman to civil court, just like the Goldman and you know, Brown families did with O.J. Do you agree?
Okay. Obviously,
yeah, yes,
I have to ask Peter for his comment.
Well, here's the thing. The family of the Martin family has a civil claim against Zimmerman, and that claim, I suspect, is basically being held in abeyance pending this criminal proceeding. If Zimmerman is found guilty, then basically liability for purposes of the civil case is fixed, and then the whole case becomes a question of the damages. Under California, the damages are essentially the family's loss of their son, and you know the jury tries to put an emotional dollar figure on that, and to the extent the family had an expectation of income, that may also come into play. Now, having said all of that, if the jury in the criminal case does not come back with a guilty verdict, in other words, the jury comes back and we say not guilty, what that translates into is the jury is saying that the prosecution, in their opinion, failed to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, therefore he is what we call acquitted. The standard in a civil trial is proof by a preponderance of the evidence and sometimes proof by clear and convincing evidence, which is considered less than beyond a reasonable doubt. So even if there comes back with an acquittal, the family still has the right to sue him civilly regardless of the jury's verdict
right. In
this case. Now, the only caveat to all of this is as a civil attorney, you can bring a lawsuit and you can get a judgment, but it's unclear who you're going to collect that judgment against. And in this particular instance, it's not clear to me that Zimmerman has any assets of any significance. It seems to me that one of the strategies of the civil judgment pursuit would also be to possibly go after the community HOA as well.
Well, wait a minute. I can tell you about that before you go into that. The family settled with HOA back in January or February.
Well, there you go. How much did they get, do you know?
No one will say it will come out because it goes over a dollar amount that you can, you know, in other words, I think it's under $1 million or up to $1 million. You don't have to come out and say it doesn't become a matter of public record.
Well,
I think over $1 million it does.
Yeah.
And it's over that amount. But, you know, at the same time, I don't believe that there's been any kind of a civil suit filed against George Zimmerman at this time.
No.
But
what typically happens is they don't file because they want to wait for the criminal proceeding to end.
Right, right.
Because their job is you know, 90% done or significantly done if the criminal case ends in a guilty verdict.
Right, and I agree with you that I think it's going to be a tough case to prove. It really comes down to a preponderance of guilt, and I don't know that the state has it all. So, you know, I mean, this is really a jury of peers that hopefully they're all honest. And from what I'm seeing is I think they're going to give the guy a fair trial.
Well, I generally speaking, I have faith in the system and faith in the process,
yes.
And I believe they are going to give him a fair trial. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But I trust the system and the process, and I believe he'll get a fair trial, and the jury will come back with what the jury concludes. I just think that given so much debate existing as to whether or not he acted in self-defense, from looking at the case from afar, it appears to indicate reasonable doubt.
Yeah, I think that you know, it could go either way, but I certainly don't disagree with you, that's for sure.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock, and we could certainly eat it up talking about George Zimmerman, but I would like to talk about the cold case. Cold, hot, cold, hot, cold. Tell us what's going on, Paul.
Well, yeah, I probably should go back and kind of tell from the beginning. On June 2nd, 1981, my father, Ronald Scharf, and his employee, Patricia Freeman, were gunned down in the back of our bar, the PM Pub. I am the P, I'm Paul. My brother is Mike, and he's the M. And this bar is outside of Chicago in Lakemore, about 44 miles northwest of Chicago. And the case went cold all the way up till 2008. And from the time that the case started, the McHenry County Sheriff's Office had always had a suspect named Glenn, and he was Patricia Freeman's boyfriend. And the motivation and theory behind it was that he was a very jealous guy, didn't like her working for my father, and therefore he may have killed my father and Patricia because of that. In 2008, my former babysitter, Holly, was taking her father back home from Illinois to Arkansas. Her father, Jim Hager, was my dad's best friend. And so she asked Jim, who do you think killed Ron? And he told her Glenn, and he also mentioned a person named Larry Newman. So Holly started Googling when she got back home, and right away Larry Newman showed up on a serial killer site and mentioned that he was from McHenry, our hometown. She started Googling a little bit more, and then she traced it back to this book called Collada. The book Collada was a biography of Frank Collada, who was a mobster, Chicago outfit associate, turned government witness. And what we found out in page 130...
And also a major member of the Hole in the Wall gang.
Yeah, if you're familiar with the movie Casino, the movie was... based on the Chicago outfit, and Joe Pesci, he played a guy named Nicky Santoro, but it was really based on real-life Tony Spilotro, who is a major Chicago enforcer, and he was the enforcer for the Las Vegas Skim. And then Robert De Niro played Sam Ace Rothstein, who was actually portrayed after Frank Lefty Rosenthal, who was a big-time bookie for the Chicago outfit. And Frank Collada was sent out to Las Vegas by Tony Spilotro to help enforce everything that he had going on out there and the Las Vegas Skim. And they were the hole-in-the-wall gang, and that was Frank's gang. And Larry Newman was part of the hole-in-the-wall gang. And what Holly found out was on page 130 of his book that Larry Newman killed my father. And the reason why he killed my father is because my father threw out his ex-wife a couple weeks earlier out of the bar for being drunk and unruly. And Larry Newman saw that as a sign of disrespect. And if you go down Larry's path, he was convicted of a triple murder back in 1956 of a bar owner, a bar employee, and a newspaper vendor outside. And what happened there was he was shortchanged a couple dollars, and he perceived that as a sign of disrespect and came back there and shot everybody with a shotgun. He got 125 years per person for the triple murder back in 1956, but only served 12 years. So, you know, based on this information, we started, you know, we asked that the case would get reopened and looked into. I found out that that Frank Collada actually gave this information back to the McHenry County Sheriff's Office back in 1982, but they never acted on any of this information, and they've always suspected Glenn. So with a little bit of more information here and there, we figured out that George Hendel was linked to the Chicago outfit through the Chicago outfit's attorney, Adam Bourgeois. And the reason why that he probably didn't want the case solved is because the Chicago outfit didn't want to give credibility to Frank Collada because he had a lot of information that he was going to be providing to the government, and a lot of people were going to go down for, you know, murders, burglaries, and things like that. So anything that they can do to discredit Frank, that's what it is that they were going to do.
Okay. Peter, you're a lawyer. How do you like it so far?
Well, I'm a big fan of the movie Casino, and it takes me back to that movie, and it sounds like I'm sorry to say it, but it sounds like a spinoff from that movie, and it's got all the makings of a melodrama. I'm just sorry it ended in tragedy, and it appears to be ongoing, and it still hasn't been fully resolved. But it's definitely a horrible tale of corruption that, you know, we've heard all too many times.
Right. Paul, back to you. I'm sorry. I just had to ask him what he thought.
Yeah, no, that's quite all right. That's quite all right. So what we had done is, you know, we got the case reopened. It's not that it was ever closed. It's a murder case. But we got them to look at it again. And in 2009... they named Larry Newman as the killer of my father and Patricia Freeman under exceptional status. The reason why it was given exceptional status because Larry Newman died in prison in 2007. So the case was decided, or at least we thought it was decided, until I went ahead and my co-author applied for the Freedom of Information Act because him and I were going to write a book together and we wanted to get the case file. Well, he filed for the Freedom of Information Act twice, and both times it was refused. To me, that wasn't a good sign. And so I was like, well, you know, we kind of told everybody that we got everything taken care of and we told everybody to go home, and it's going to be really hard to kind of get the press and everything else going. So let's go ahead and we'll write the book, and then with the book, we'll go ahead and file for the Freedom of Information Act again and see what happens. So it was almost 3 years later, we wrote the book, and I applied for the Freedom of Information Act, and I did get part of my father's file. But I didn't get all of it. And knowing McHenry, knowing Illinois, I wanted to look over everything. So I filed an appeal with the Public Access Bureau here in the state of Illinois, and they took up my appeal, and they felt like I had some merit to it, and they asked the sheriff's office to provide all the information unredacted and to also provide explanations for each reason that they gave me a denial. Well, I recently received a letter, and the letter to me was kind of strange because they were asking me to respond to something in a 7-day time period, and I'm not really sure what I was to respond to because the state did not take a position or did they take any action. So what I did is I took a look at who was responding to the state's request, and it wasn't the Freedom of Information Act officer, which was strange because they're the ones that are qualified to respond to such appeals. They're trained in the law, and they have to get updated certification on an annual basis to maintain the title as a Freedom of Information Act officer. So who responded was a gentleman named Donald Least. And what I know about Donald Least is he's the equal opportunity officer / legal affairs officer in the sheriff's department. And he always shows up whenever anybody is going after Sheriff Nygren. And some of the accusations that have been going against Sheriff Nygren have been quite a few, from bad practices in campaigning all the way to solicitation of murdering a judge and everything in between. And Don Leese shows up, and the best that I can tell, he obstructs, he delays. And so right now, I was thinking I was chasing after ghosts because almost everybody in relation to my father's case is dead. But I know now I tripped the sheriff's wire, and I have reason to think that maybe I'm chasing after some people that are still alive.
Okay. Peter, you have chased after ghosts in your time. How would you handle this?
What is the primary thing that you want to get right now? What's the most immediate thing that you want?
Have my everything in that file, the entire file.
And they have sent you a letter basically stating that they're not going to give you the file, or what exactly are they saying in relation to your request for the file?
Well, on the last letter that I received, it wasn't clear, you know, because I expected my response to come from the Public Access Bureau, and they basically sent me a copy of a letter from Donald Leese saying that what they've done is they can't provide any of this information because it all belongs now to the LEADS program. The LEADS program is a law enforcement database that citizens would never gain access to. And so what I stated was I reinstated my request that I want everything from the file, and two, just because they put it into the LEADS program doesn't mean that it deserves protection under the LEADS program.
Well, is there some... See, basically what you need to do, in my opinion, is to, quote-unquote, go to court. Now, when I say go to court, and I put that in quotes, it's because sometimes there are different courts and different proceedings that apply to different types of situations. I'm not sure if there's any kind of administrative panel that hears claims under your request for information authority that resolves that. If you dispute our decision, you may appeal to this agency, appeal to that agency, go to this proceeding, go to that proceeding. So I don't know what statutory framework is in place that gives you a recourse if you're not happy with the decision. There almost always is some sort of recourse that the statutory scheme provides. And if that does not satisfy you or does not meet with your approval, then the next step is to basically go to court and say to the court, it's something in California that we call a petition for a writ of mandate. And this petition for a writ of mandate is when you go to the court and you say, they're not doing what they're supposed to do. I request that you issue an order of mandamus, which mandates that they do what I'm asking them to do. And then the court, if you prevail, issues an order and it tells the agency or the entity or the whatever it may be, you shall do this. Give him the entire file or whatever it is. And unfortunately, as you can see, there's a fair amount of work involved with that. But nobody, in my experience, it's rare to just get something just by asking for it, if there's any incentive at all not to turn it over, whether it's a proper incentive or an improper incentive. If they don't have an incentive to turn it over, they won't give it to you, and they will force you to basically make someone force them to give it to you. And that's why we have courts, because nobody just comes in and does what they're supposed to do. They have to take it to a separate panel to have it resolved.
Okay.
And that's correct. And that's similar to my situation here in Illinois. I'm not sure if the verbiage is exactly the same, but the actions are exactly the same, that I do have an opportunity to go ahead and take it to the court. And I did take a risk by going through this channel here, because if the Public Access Bureau does make a judgment either way, that if I do take it to court, that the court will consider that judgment in this as well.
I don't think that's a risk. I think that's what you should do, because what the court wants to see typically is the court wants to see something called an exhaustion of administrative remedies. The court wants to see you do everything you can within the framework of whatever administrative system exists. It wants to see you exhaust all those remedies before you come to it and say, "Dear court, I've exhausted all my remedies. They're still not doing what they're supposed to do." So I wouldn't, in my opinion, based on what I've heard today, I wouldn't refrain from doing it just because you think you might get an adverse ruling and then that the court will see it. I think that's what you need to do, and then you need to show the adverse ruling to the court and say they got it wrong. Now, the risk is, as you point out, the court will look at the ruling and it will say, "Yeah, it's adverse, but I agree with their analysis. I agree with what they did." If you don't do that, then when you get to the court will say, "Well, you didn't make your application to them, and you didn't let them rule on this, so I can't rule on it until they're done ruling on it." So either way, you could end up back there anyway. So in my opinion, that's usually the best thing to do: go through with the process.
Okay, let's talk OJ for a second. You obviously went through this process, you know, trying to get OJ's assets. How successful were you?
I think that we were extremely successful. I think it depends on how you measure success. But, the thing with OJ is he had a criminal prosecution that ended, 1995 roughly. And it ended, as everyone knows, with an acquittal. And then, just as we talked about before, after the criminal phase ended, the civil process got underway. And that didn't end till around 1997. Well, from 1994 to 1997, OJ had money, he had assets, he had resources, he was still a popular figure, and he had the ability to hire many lawyers to give him advice to prepare for the possibility of a civil judgment being entered against him. So by the time the judgment was entered against him for millions and millions of dollars, he had had time to prepare for it. And as a result of all that, he rendered himself essentially judgment-proof. And there were many efforts made for many years before I got involved to try to go after various assets, and it was very difficult, if not impossible. He lived in Florida. He had the benefit of a homestead exemption, and he had created pensions, and he created pensions for himself, and these pensions created monies that could not be touched by judgment collection. So when I got involved 10 years after the judgments were entered, I got involved 2006, 2007, very little, if any, had been collected. And it was then that circumstances came into place that he published this book, and that book became an asset that we could target. And it was a controversial book. And, it was unclear if we were going to be able to, quote-unquote, monetize it and convert it into a liquid asset. But we pursued it because the law gave us the remedy. And in my opinion, we did realize money from that, a significant low six-figure sum, depending on how you measure these things. But I think the real success that was achieved with this is I think that this process of taking this book out of his mouth and out of his control – really angered him and upset him and drove him into doing something that was crazy and what I believe was an attempt for him to regain a speaking platform for himself. We were taking away his speaking platform he needed to construct another speaking platform. And what he concocted was this crazy hotel break-in that he thought would give him a stage to speak on. And everybody knows how that turned out. And then he complicated it even further by refusing to do a plea bargain because he was convinced that he could escape this process just as he had done before. And as everyone knows, it all blew up in his face. So I believe from a monetary sense, we were very successful considering how difficult it was to get anything out of this guy. And from a big picture sense, in terms of justice, it was an absolute home run out of the park, in my opinion. We got more justice than we could have possibly imagined.
And by the way, I have two versions of the book. The one that was never, ever published, and the one that did.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that was an important part of taking words out of his mouth. Because if you have the book that he tried to publish that was basically prepared by HarperCollins, it features a nice, glamorous shot of him back in the criminal trial. He's a good-looking man, and they've got him there, and I forget what pose he's doing. And then it has these big, huge words, "if I did it." And the "if" is emphasized. The "if" is huge. And this was the way Simpson wanted to package this statement. He wanted to portray himself well. He actually thought, in my opinion, that this book would not exonerate him of the crime, but redeem himself in the public's eye. And when we took it, what happened to the "if," Simon, in the cover that you have?
Oh, okay. The "if" got really small.
The "if" got really small, and instead of a glamorous picture of him, the front of the book was made to look like a crime scene. So we took the view that this was the way someone like Simpson confesses to a crime. He took the view, and he attempted to package it as, "I'm not as bad as people think." And we said, well, we don't agree with him that he's not as bad as people think, but what this really shows is he's admitting to all of you that he did it. And so we believe this constitutes a confession. And when we published the book, the same exact book, we put a different cover on it, and we shrunk the "if." And what you see is, "I did it." And I think that's the correct packaging. I think that's the way it was supposed to be done. And I think that's part of what drove him nuts, as he walked around and he saw this book staring at him everywhere that said, "I did it."
Yeah.
Bravo.
I have to admit, I was just laughing all the way. You know, one version, you know, "if I did it," and the other version, "if I did it."
The "if" is there, but it's very small.
"If" is really small.
Oh, he's right on the money. I think he's right on the money.
This is what I say to people. You know, it's a long-winded answer to a simple question. Were we successful? I think we were successful, quite frankly, more than I could have possibly imagined. I think justice came, and it came in an indirect, circuitous, strange manner. But I think that sometimes that's the way justice works. It works in strange ways. And that's why I try to tell people, you know, you got to have faith in the process. You've got to have faith in the system. You've got to pursue the system. And if you keep trying, eventually you get there. But I understand that it's easy to say, and it's very, very hard to do, because the system is flawed. Sometimes the system is corrupt. The other people you're fighting against don't play fair. And it's very hard. It's easy to talk about doing the right thing and pursuing it. It's hard to actually do it. And it took the Goldmans the better part of more than a decade to get there. And it's not easy. Not easy by any stretch of the imagination.
Hear, hear.
Okay, jump in.
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, how Peter was perceiving O.J. and that book. And, you know, being the co-author of my book, that's absolutely how I'm using my book. It gives me a platform to tell the story. I use it for talking engagements, and it helps me keep my father's story out there. So control of that book is really important to me. I can imagine what OJ must have been thinking when that was taken away, because the talking platform, I mean, if you look at what I have, Simon, that's all I have. And for him not to have that, that was a best way to get into his crawl. And, you know, again, bravo.
Well,
outstanding.
You know, again, it's difficult to foresee these things, but as the situation was unfolding, and as creating a book gives you a platform to speak. Not everyone will read the book, but it gives you an opportunity to talk about it. And talking about it can be as valuable as anything. It's a platform for discussion. And as we were talking about taking the book and publishing it and selling it, it created a tremendous amount of controversy. And the very same day that the book was coming out and we were making these conversational points on a number of TV networks, that was the very evening that he chose to act. People don't really know that, but it was that night that he broke into the Vegas courtroom. I'm convinced that it's not just a coincidence. He wanted to try to seize the stage back. And then when he was convicted, he refused to take a plea, which in my opinion was insane. And then when he was convicted, what's the first thing he did? He got up and he talked. He just kept talking. And he kept talking about all the things that I think he wanted to talk about all along. He was craving a stage. And then he went through this whole process of filing this recent petition to have a retrial. And what did he do? He wanted to get up there and talk. And that was something that's been driving him all this time. He keeps wanting to talk. His problem is that whatever he's saying becomes less and less valuable with each passing day. And, so be it. That's the price you pay for wanting to talk about something that he never had to talk about. He was scot-free. He was home free. And another thing that people don't think of, they think, well, part of what he was mad about the book was losing the money. He got $660,000 for that book before we even knew the book existed, and he got that money. And he didn't have to do any of this. He could have just taken the money and let the book go and let it all pass. But, you know, he was driven by his own internal demons to put himself in the situation he's now in. And that's part of the pursuit of justice. And that's part of what happens with every one of these things. Eventually, it catches up with them. But again, I know that's easy to say. It's very hard to actually do.
Okay. So he got $660,000.
It's a lot more than the Goldmans got for selling the book, I can tell you that.
Right. And as I recall, he actually set up at least one shell account. Yeah.
He set up a shell corporation, and that was the key. That was the key to his undoing. And you know, I could go into all the steps that preceded the Vegas bank hotel bust in, but every step was an escalation of the previous step before it, and every step was an attempt to thwart the taking away of the book. And every step kept backfiring. There were things he did beforehand that contributed to it. For instance, you say he created a shell. He did. He created a shell LLC called Lorraine Brooke Associates. It was actually, I forget whether it was an Inc. or an LLC, but it was based in Florida. And it was nothing more than a hollow shell. But he gave to that shell, that corporate entity, all the rights to the book. So when he transferred it to the entity, that gave us a target to go after. We went after the entity. And then what killed it for him was he actually thought that if he put this entity into bankruptcy, that would somehow keep us from getting the book. But it ended up facilitating getting the book because it was through bankruptcy that we were able to get the entire book. What we were going to do is sell the book rights at a sheriff's sale in California. And that would have given us some money, and it would have given us some book rights, but it was unclear what those book rights would have been. But once he put the entity in bankruptcy and the entity had the book rights, the bankruptcy court was then capable of giving all of the book rights to the Goldman family. So the very effort to thwart us turned out to undermine him even more, and he just kept going. He wouldn't stop. And it led to this Vegas thing, which followed thereafter. And he kept going, and he wouldn't stop. You know, he had plenty of opportunities to take a plea deal that would have got him a few years. He would have been out by now, but he wouldn't do it. So, you know, it's just this never-ending domino theory with him that's taken him to this place that he is now. And he's not the only one. This is, in my opinion, the way life works. And it's easy to say, but it's hard to pursue.
Paul, I'm sure you're sat there going, no. Yeah, Heisman winning, football player. This can't be true.
No, well, I mean, you know, like everybody else, I mean, I've seen it on TV and how it all portrayed out. And I think he was delusional that he was somehow going to right himself with the public once again based on who he was. And it kind of makes me think that that's what we saw out of this was his disillusion of being able to do that, and it just turned to absolute dysfunction for him, and he earned his way to where he is now. So he undid more of himself than if he would have just shut up and sat there. He done more to himself than anybody else.
That's
well,
right.
Yeah, in my opinion, it's a good idea that, you know, if you're a well-known football player, it's not a good idea to kill your wife and her boyfriend. But, I could be wrong.
Well, let me put it to you this way. I deal with this kind of stuff all the time, and, all of it's evil, all of it's wrong. But, if you lose it one night and you absolutely go berserk and you do something horrible, as he did, and you're accused of it, you're put on trial for it, you survive that trial, you escape, you have your freedom back, you've been through the deathly hallows. I mean, you almost got convicted of a capital crime for which you could have been put to death, and you escape that. And 10 years later, this is the mother of your children, you decide to write a book, If I Did It. This is not the way an innocent person would behave. You wouldn't, if you were really innocent, you never would write that book. You never would put that target on your back. You would sit there and you'd feel whatever you'd feel. You'd have your own demons, but you wouldn't write a book taunting everybody about, well, if I did it, here's how it went down. And in the act of doing that, he only further confirmed his guilt, in my opinion. But he also had built-in defense mechanisms. He had a ghostwriter with that book, and he kept trying to have control. He kept trying to be able to say, well, I'm not saying I did it, but if I did, this is what it would be. And I think he thought in his deluded mind that if the public reacted poorly to this, he would say, A, well, I never said I did it, and B, I didn't write that. That's what the ghostwriter wrote. And so he had all these defense mechanisms built into it so that he could try to read whichever way it would go. All of it crazy. It was all crazy. So just pure insanity.
Paul, I have to ask you, where are you taking your mission next?
Well, I'm just going to, hang steadfast, but what I'm doing with everything is, I'm blogging about this stuff on a weekly level, blogging about what's going on in McHenry, and I'm going to utilize this as an opportunity to hopefully make some change. The investigative officer, the second investigative officer, Andrew Zanke, has put his hat in for sheriff. And, based on my experience and what I know, there is no way that him becoming sheriff is going to be a benefit of the community of McHenry County. He is part of that Good Old Boy Network, and he's going to be a continuance onto this Good Old Boy Network, and I'm going to do whatever I can to stop it. And I believe I'm getting some traction with this. People are paying attention. People that 5 years ago, if I would have told them the story and how corrupt McHenry was, I don't think that they would believe it. But because of a few things that have been happening back in McHenry, this is really the opportunity now to go ahead and tell this story, and it's going to sway the opinions of people, and I think that's going to be his undoing, and hopefully it's going to be an undoing of the bigger apparatus that supports all this.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about Zanke. I know you don't like him.
No, I don't. And, you know, the reason why I don't is the way that he dealt with me. There was an absolute arrogance about the way that he dealt me or with the way that he tried not to deal with me. I'd make a bunch of phone calls, you know, just following up, and I didn't call a lot. I mean, I rarely called. You know, I called, you know, once or twice a month. But he wouldn't return any of my phone calls. He didn't feel like he had to. And I was on the news as the family representative to everything. I'm not sure how he felt like he didn't have to communicate to me. And what I found appalling with him was the way that he tried to manage information or try to control not getting information to me. And, you know, basically when everything was all said and done, what I was summed up with was everything that I already knew from the book Collada, and there was an additional piece of information that the woman that caused my father to get killed and Debbie Newman to get killed, or Patricia Freeman to be killed, was Debbie Newman. And what she had said is that my father had raped her, and that was the reason why Larry went berserk. So the only piece of information that I got from him that was new was this piece of information. And I felt like that was contrived. Not that she didn't say that, because she certainly did. And I got the police reports or the witness statement where she did tell the police officers that. But that wasn't the only information that was of certain value that they told me about. They didn't tell me that the original investigator was being investigated by the FBI. They didn't tell me that the original investigator was subpoenaed by Tony Spilotro's attorney to go ahead and testify on his behalf. Then I also found a newspaper article, actually that was given to me through Dennis Arnoldy, who is Frank Collada's FBI debriefer, where in this article, you know, back in 1982, George Hendel and Ted Flora, the state's attorney, flew out to San Diego to be debriefed by Frank Collada on the murders. Well, in this newspaper article, a civilian attorney is talking about what transpired there. And what's wrong about this is nobody was charged or nothing was charged based on this information. So how did this private attorney get information about this government witness, this conversation that was had? And this attorney turns out to be the attorney for the Chicago outfit. And he was going to use George Hendel in the Robert Brown murder investigation that Larry did. He was going to have George Hendel testify on Larry Newman's behalf, which is just absolutely insane. Like I mentioned, Larry Newman was convicted of a triple murder. George Hendel should have been investigating Larry Newman on the double murder that he had. But now he's going to go ahead and testify on Larry Newman's behalf in another murder that he later was charged with and put to, away for life. So, you know, none of that information came to the top. just that my dad is the rapist. That was the only new piece of information that he gave me. And so he is part of the system that's been in place that now I believe has been protecting people. And I know that I must be close to finding out who those people are, because I tripped the sheriff's wire, and now instead of this being a Freedom of Information Act thing, we got it being something else. That now the sheriff's got basically a personal lawyer on the tax people's dollar, now replying back to me and the Public Access Bureau. It's absolutely insane.
Okay, Peter, I have to bounce this to you. That's a huge amount of information. Freedom of Information Act seems to be breached. What would you recommend?
Well, I think it's all still the same thing. You have to work with whatever regulatory administrative scheme is in place, pursue all your remedies, and if you can't get what you believe you're entitled to in that manner, then you quote-unquote take it to the next level, which is you petition a court in the jurisdiction that this applies to, and you ask the court to order it to be done. And that's all easy to say, but again, I know that's very hard to do. And to add another layer to it is, you need attorneys for this, and attorneys don't come cheap. And that is sometimes an insurmountable burden to overcome, just insurmountable. And it's unfortunate, but these are just realities that unfortunately are there. And the agencies that sometimes deny these requests and tell you no, they're banking on the fact, sometimes, not always, but sometimes they're banking on the fact that they know you can't really take it to the next level. And it's kind of like a landlord that just won't let go of your security deposit, even though they know they're supposed to. They want to see who's going to fight, who's going to push them, and who's not. And unfortunately, sometimes you don't have the ability to push them. This isn't the kind of thing you could just go to small claims court and say they should give me this information, and they're not doing it. It requires you to go to court actually, and that's a very expensive process, unfortunately.
Yeah, I concur with that.
Yeah,
and
I'm sure that wasn't the answer you were looking for, Peter. Oh, sorry, Paul.
No, but I mean, it's the answer that I understood, And so, I got to keep my goal and objectives in mind with that. So if I'm unable to, find an attorney, and it would have to be pro bono. I mean, I definitely don't have the money for something like this, but if I can't get something in that fashion, what we do have is public opinion, and I'm doing everything very transparent. I keep everybody in tune, and I blog about that. In the eyes of the public, they don't understand, just like I don't understand, how is it that this is a 32-year-old murder case that is already named the murderer, and the people involved are all dead just about, that you just don't provide this son's request to provide him the paperwork that everything was decided on. And I think the people are getting that. They're disgusted by that. And it's going to formulate an opinion, and I hope it formulates an opinion to an action of voting and knocking down Andrew Zanke. He's created problems for himself, outside of this stuff. There was a deputy that tried to get a grand jury indictment against him. This deputy was on the narcotics office in McHenry, and he was working with the DEA on a case. Well, it turns out that the case that they were working on was a gentleman named Brian Good, and he owns the Rita Corporation. Well, that is Zanke's lead contributor to his campaign. So he told Brian Good that he was being investigated on, and kind of blew this big drug bust. Apparently there was, oh God, I want to say it's a truckload of pot. I want to say 60,000 pounds, but I don't know that for sure. But the bottom line is, you've got the undersheriff of McHenry County undermining, you know, this drug investigation. And it blows me away that now the internal investigations don't find any error with what he has done. And, you know, that just screams fishiness. Then you got my case. And then, like I mentioned, Sheriff Nygren's got accusations, you know, head high against him, all the way up to two solicitations of murder. One was a coroner who was running for sheriff. I believe his name is David Buchanan. And a judge, Judge Floater, that he solicited a deputy to go ahead and murder, and this deputy now is coming forward saying that that's what happened. So, I mean, it's just out of control. We have, we also have Mexican illegal aliens being funneled from Mexico to McHenry County based under the guidance of Sheriff Nygren. I mean, these accusations, and that's what they are at the moment, is accusations. To me, the perception of all this just creates a dysfunction that if it was, if we had the la creme sheriff's office, that they couldn't perform and function appropriately because nobody trusts what it is that they do. So just the perception of everything is a dysfunction. And I hope people, you know, perceive it at that and vote it out.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I've often told people that the highest court in the land, the very highest court in the land, is the court of public opinion. And it's much more accessible than other courts. And the evidentiary rules and due process requirements are much lower. And it's sometimes the only court of grievance that people have, and I'm glad you're aware of that.
Yeah, it's the biggest arrow that I have. I can afford maintaining a website. I can't afford an attorney. And, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, how you look at it is all the craziness to my father's story does appeal to people, and it engages them. So people are engaged in following what's going on with this, and you know, and it's creating a lot of chatter back in McHenry County. So it's not just me saying the stuff that I'm saying. There's deputies that are, you know, inside the organization that are coming out saying what they have to say, and you know, the people in McHenry. You know, they grew up thinking, you know, they were part of this old farm town. That's where we got our roots, this farming community, and that these kind of things don't happen in a little sleepy town or community like McHenry County. But people are saying, you know what, there's just too much stuff here, and I bet you it is going on. And they are being disgusted, and I think they are having enough of this. And hopefully that will mean votes, and that we're going to, you know, take these people out. That's all we can do.
I do hope you're successful. And I have to wrap this up. It's Father's Day, and apparently I'm a father. Only a couple of times. But I want to thank you two gentlemen for taking part in the program today. A very, very important discussion. Peter, your final thoughts?
Well, I just, again, I want to wish you, everyone, a happy Father's Day. And I think it's, you know, what we've talked about here today is a son's tribute to his father and his pursuit of justice for him. And I wish you all the best in that. And I thank you very much for being a part of the show again today.
Well, thank you.
And Paul, your wrap-up thoughts.
Yeah, well, I just want to wish everybody a happy Father's Day, and I want to thank you, Simon, for giving me the opportunity to talk about my father today, and that I hope everybody stays engaged and follows me. My website is McHenryCounty1981.com, so please follow me there. I also have my book, Murder in McHenry. That's available on Amazon, both soft cover and Kindle. Please go ahead and take a look at that. And, you know, let's do something. Let's promote change. This is about a community. Let's make it a community thing. And let's make our voices heard by standing up and being counted.
And I'll give a real good shout-out to Paul's book, My Pictures in It.
That's true. You're part of the story, Simon.
Right. Gentlemen, thank you so much for taking part today. And have a great Sunday. And let's talk again very soon.
That sounds like a plan, Simon. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Until next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week. We'll be back again next Sunday. Till then, goodbye.